Hello everyone, I am Jessica Saxton, the Environmental Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and the host of Living Downstream. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Mulala, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer, and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute.
Welcome. I have foraging expert Jordan Weiss with us here today to learn about mushrooms, when and where to find them, and more. So thank you everyone for joining us today. To start off, we're just going to begin with an introduction. Jordan, if you want to introduce yourself and talk about what you do.
Thank you, Jessica. So my name is Jordan Weiss, and I have been living in the Portland, Oregon area since 2001. And been engaged with mushrooms since the late 70s. I read Paul Stamets' first book, Psilocybe Mushrooms and Their Allies, in 1978, and it set me on a course to be able to have mushrooms be an integral part of my life. There were a few years where I didn't do much with them, but then they would come back to me in dreams, or I'd go backpacking or hiking, or I would be in an area where they were fruiting. It was pretty much a casual fascination with fungi up until 2004. In 2004, I had a dream where I saw a hillside that was covered with burlap, and it was, I saw the trees, the plants, and the fungi emerging out of the burlap in succession. So that was a pretty, it was an important dream, as I was able to consider. And then the next day I started Googling different things about mycology. I Googled mycotechnology, which is industrial processes that utilize fungus. And I found out that there has been an amazing amount of work that has been done for decades. And in 2004, not much of this information had reached the public sector. So I continued to further my relationship with mushrooms. I moved to an intentional community here in Portland, Oregon, and I was doing volunteer work with a couple of others. And I noticed that there was mushrooms coming up in their gardens that they didn't know what they were. They were eating them, but they didn't know what they were. I think somebody told them that they were edible mushrooms, but they didn't actually try to identify them. So we identified them as King Stropharia mushrooms, and they were growing in garden beds that had tomatoes and herbs, and we ate them, and they were wonderful. Paul Stamets' book, Mycelium Running, came out the next year, and we took some of those methods and techniques in that book, and we applied them to the intentional community where I was staying. That spring of 2006, we were watering the gardens a lot. For an eight-week period, we had about a pound and a half of King Stropharia mushrooms fruiting every other day. So it was an amazing amount of mushrooms. We were able to take people in there and show them what we did and talk about them. Since then, I've spoken with dozens of groups and led forays and have presented, I don't even know how many times, to many, many different groups, mycological societies, gardening clubs, schools. The one message I get about mushrooms is that every year more and more people are interested in engaging with them, and there is not nearly enough outreach to be able to satisfy the huge demand on what people want to know about them, which is everything.
Thank you. That was great information. I guess my first question would be, what is mycology?
Well, that's a good question. Mycology is the study of fungi. So mushrooms are the sexual reproduction units of an underground vegetative body. Much like an apple tree provides apples, the mycelium is comparable to the tree, and it produces mushrooms. And these contain spores, which will be disseminated in the wind, spread out throughout their habitats. Some funguses have a way of distributing their spores from random acts of nature, like puffballs. Some fungi, like Hypogeus fungus, which grow underground, rely on animals to dig them up, to eat them, and then to scatter their spores through their scat. Funguses are very adaptive here on Earth. They are keystone indicator species in nearly every terrestrial habitat that they live in here on Earth. So when we look at mycology, we're looking at the life cycle of mushrooms. We're looking at the taxonomy, the various parts of the mushrooms themselves. And we're also looking at the ecological niches to a lesser extent, but certainly not less important. With mycology, we also look for traditional usages that people have had around the world and in this country over the ages. And mycotechnology is another expression of mycology. And when people look at mycotechnology, they're looking at ways where fungus can be implemented into industrial processes or biological processes. So some people have gone out and they've come up with mycoforestry, which means that they are inoculating their trees with certain types of mycorrhizal fungus. Mycorrhizal fungus is basically symbiotic funguses. This is a class of funguses. This is a group of funguses that establish symbiotic relationship with their hosts. And those hosts are vascular plants, such as Doug fir trees and oak trees. There's ethnomycology, which people will study about what different groups around the world have used mushrooms as healing agents in traditional ceremonies, and what their roles are in nature. So mycology is a big umbrella. There's a lot of things that come under it. It's very spacious. It allows a lot of people to engage in mycology in a way that makes them excited about it. It's not something that you have to learn everything about mycology before you can appreciate them. If you go out into the forest during the fall here in Oregon, and if it happens to be a wet fall and you see a lot of colorful mushrooms, that's appreciating mycology on a very basic and important level, just acknowledging them and seeing them. And once you go down the mycological rabbit hole, you'll find that there's very little stopping you.
Thank you. That was great. I did not know mycology was so vast of an umbrella. Mm-hmm. Wow. So speaking about the lighting and coloring, what color of light has the most positive effect on mushroom formation?
I don't have direct experience with this, but I've heard from some cultivators that light in the blue part of the color spectrum has the most effect on mushrooms. Mushrooms in general, they will exhibit a phototropic response to sunlight. And that means in lay terms that they will direct themselves towards the light when they're growing. And that gives them the idea of when to sporulate. The whole purpose of a mushroom forming is for spores to be distributed into the habitat so new colonies can come up. Many mushrooms will fruit in the dark, but mushrooms do better when there's a little bit of light that they can orient themselves towards.
That makes sense. So what nutrients or fertilizers are the best at boosting mushrooms, either out in the wild or growing them at home?
That's a very good question. There are four general relationships that fungus has in nature. That's parasitism. It's an organism that lives off of a live host, sometimes at the expense of the host life. There's saprobism, which means an organism that lives off of dead and or dying substrate, and that encompasses all of the mushrooms we've been able to cultivate in the past couple thousand years. There's mutualism. They have their own term for it, mycorrhizal. So myco means fungus and rhizal means root in Latin. You put the two together and you get fungal root. There's a fourth type of relationship that mushrooms have in their environment called epiphytism or endophytism. So this is where the fungus will grow on like the roots of a tree and the mycelium of another fungus, or it can even be in some mushrooms will grow in between the cell walls of plants, and they won't do anything until the plant dies. So they will start off, they'll start off kind of with a benign relationship where they're just along for the ride. But then when the plant dies, since that fungus is already in the cells, it can go from a endophytic relationship to a saprobic relationship. And it's already has a food source there for it waiting. So mushrooms in their habitat are scavengers mostly. The saprobic mushrooms are scavengers. So they're going to be eating a wide variety of things, inorganic compounds. When mushrooms are in the soil and they come across heavy metal pollution, it's usually in its elemental form. So the mushroom mycelium will not break down elemental metals, but it will sequester them into the fruit body away from the vital processes that the mushrooms do to continue their life cycle. For people to add nutrients and fertilizers for mushrooms, they, in culture, or when we grow them, rye berries have enough nutrition, enough complex nutrition for them to complete their entire life cycle and to fruit. Sawdust is a transfer medium. They like to eat sawdust, but it's kind of like popcorn for them. It can't really sustain them. Sometimes you'll notice shaggy manes growing in fields that have a lot of manures in them or chemical fertilizers, and those are reduced down to nitrates and nitrites by the mycelium. So the shaggy mane mycelium will feed on those compounds in the soil. When we're growing mushrooms in cultures, inside or outdoors, we can use manures. We can use composted manures. We can use a matrix of organic materials like cardboard, sawdust, coir, wood chips. I like to use freshly chipped wood chips that have been soaked in water, so they're still wet. Oyster mushrooms can fruit directly on straw. We like to use oat straw for those projects. So mushrooms have, the saprobic mushrooms have a wider variety of substrates that they can utilize as food sources than the mycorrhizal mushrooms. So mycorrhizal mushrooms are chanterelles, they're truffles, they're king boletes, they're shrubusolas, they're pig's ears. They would be started, ideally, you would get a liquid culture of these funguses and you would dip baby trees in the roots. You would have the roots come in contact with some of that liquid mycelium, and there's a chance that that mycelium could grow on the roots and that the mushroom, the fungus would be able to grow with the tree as a supportive member of its community. Chanterelles take about 40 years to appear in nature. And with further research, we might find out that these ectomycorrhizal species that we've been collecting for millennia can be grown in faster time frames. People have been working with truffles, the French Perigord truffle, on oak trees for, in this country, it may be 40 or 50 years. It may be much older in other countries, but there are places that have managed to grow truffles by planting inoculated oak trees in California, in North Carolina, and in other parts of the world as well. So we don't really grow the parasitic mushrooms. They're here. We don't really want to encourage them, like the honey mushroom. And the endophytic mushrooms, we don't know much about them, but they could very well play a part in our outdoor grow spaces and our food security and the recycling of nutrients in future years. But right now, with the saprobic mushrooms, those are oyster mushrooms, those are shiitakes, those are lion's mane, those are chicken of the woods. These can all be grown on a wide variety of substrates. And even after the publication of Paul Stamets' books 30 plus years ago, there's still more questions than are answered. There's a lot more information we don't know than we do know, but the little information we know has been able to be translated into people cultivating mushrooms at home for hobby scale or for businesses. And it's a field that is growing in popularity and product yields exponentially every year.
So you mentioned that chanterelles, they take 40 years to grow?
This is, These were anecdotal observations from people that I've talked with who were raised on tree farms. The one person said that they remember growing up on a tree farm and walking through their 500 acres of trees in Columbia County for years. And they remember by the time they were in their 40s that they remembered they saw their first chanterelles appear in these forests. It's not a definitive fact. And it would be nice to know actually how long it does take inoculated trees to produce mushrooms. I think a lot of that's proprietary information right now, and the people that are working with it have a vested interest in bringing these processes for commodification, and in order to spread the information widely, it does have to follow a commercial course. And that said, people can do things open source. They can do them in the context of community. But in our current financial situations and the way we live our lives, we're still needing to make money for most of our daily aspects of life. And that said, there are people working in permaculture situations where they've inoculated different trees with different types of ectomycorrhizal fungus. And it's more than likely that that information would become public quicker than if somebody was working in the private sector, like at a lab, or if they had maybe a larger overhead.
Moving on to the next question. How can I determine an edible from a toxic mushroom?
That may be the most important question in this interview. A long time ago, before there were books and before science was much, much more accessible than it is today, people relied on oral traditions and anecdotal reports if mushrooms were edible. So this, I think there's many stories where people ate mushrooms for a long time and maybe a few of them died. Maybe a few of them had consciousness shifts. Maybe some of them had stomach aches, but maybe some of them didn't receive any ill effects. So if they ate a mushroom, and they may not have been cooked, all mushrooms have to be cooked to be eaten. They're made of chitin, and chitin in another cellular arrangement is bug exoskeletons and lobster shells. They're really hard for the body to digest. There's very few organisms in nature that can digest chitin. And luckily for humans, that chitin can be made a little bit more digestible if it's cooked into foods that we already like. So we cannot survive on a diet of just cooked mushrooms alone. We need to eat other foods. We need to have relatively complex minerals and combinations of different nutrients to be able to have an optimal diet. So people would rely on these old tales to figure out if mushrooms were edible, and all of the old folk tales, they used to be called wives' tales, but I think that the men were perpetuating this misinformation as much as anybody else. All of those old folk tales turned out to be not true or misleading. There's no shortcuts to being able to safely identify mushrooms. You need to know each species that you plan on eating. Luckily, there are there's different ways to be able to identify mushrooms. I like to teach people how to utilize macroscopic identification characteristics for fungi. Macroscopic identification means it's aspects of the mushroom that you can see without a microscope or without a hand lens. So when we look at macroscopic identification characteristics for mushrooms, we're looking at how the gills are attached to the stem. We're looking at the texture of the cap. We're looking for the presence of any staining. We look for any odors. We look for the fruiting pattern, if it's fruiting in singles, in troops, or in clusters. Is it growing on the ground, or is it growing on wood? Is it growing on other mushrooms? Ecological habitat, the trees and the environments where they grow are another macroscopic identification characteristic. In Amanitas, there are remains of the universal veil on the base, which are valuable identification clues. So there are some mushrooms that we can discern that are edible species by putting a small piece on our tongue and waiting for a reaction. That would be with Bilitis, and that would be with Rucellos. The Rucellos and Bilitis that are edible will be mild, and the Rucellos and Bilitis that are not edible will be either extremely bitter or acrid. And that's really hot. It's not a culinary kind of hot. It's just a kind of burn your mouth and tongue kind of hot. Once we learn the macroscopic identification characteristics for mushrooms, and there's also spore prints, but spore prints take a few hours to get. And there's some people who use reagents like a KOH, and they'll drop these chemicals on the mushroom flesh, and certain species will turn certain colors. So using all of these together would be better than using either of them. But once we identify a mushroom in the field, we pick it, we take it home and cook it and eat it, we have this embodied experience that can last a lifetime for each species. Once you do that successfully with one mushroom, you can do it with all mushroom species. And as an added bonus, once you use macroscopic identification characteristics to identify mushrooms, you can also apply that same set of tools and you can identify anything in nature. You can identify trees, you can identify bushes, berries, bugs, fish, insects, animals. You can identify rocks, fossils. Birds move a little bit faster. If you look up in the sky, you can identify nebula and stellar structures by what we see and the little bit of physical information that we know about these galaxies that are very, very far distances away. As an example, when I'm walking through the forest in the spring, if I'm in a riparian area where there's cottonwoods or there's alders or there's maples, if I see white mushrooms growing on a tree, a stump, or a log that are kind of stacked up together, I notice this fruiting pattern, and I can tell that those are oyster mushrooms. So if they're too high up on the tree, I'll leave them. If I'm really hungry, I'll find a stick and knock them down. I can recognize whether the oyster mushrooms are past their prime for picking or whether they're in perfect state to pick. So with a little bit of experience and a little bit of learning, these skills are not difficult to learn. If you have an interest and a curiosity, you can learn how to use macroscopic identification characteristics for mushrooms and other things in nature in an hour, maybe an hour and a half.
How do you determine that a mushroom is still good to pick or it's gone bad already?
Most mushrooms will get soft when they have matured. The spores will exacerbate decomposition. So in the case of the oyster mushrooms, the first day and a half that they have fruited and right before their caps expand, that's the best time to pick them. As little as a day after their caps expand, they start to decompose on the tree. Some mushrooms like truffles need to be enjoyed when they're ripe. I find that lobster mushrooms are better enjoyed when they're ripe as opposed to when they're young and firm. Don't pick ripe lobster mushrooms from the ground. They're usually filled with bacteria that can make us sick. The way to ascertain whether mushrooms are poisonous or not is to know which species we are collecting at the time and to be able to access the resources on each mushroom species. So as I stated earlier, we know considerably less about mushrooms than we do more, but the little that we know has made it possible for us to have a lifelong engagement with well over thousands of species around the mushrooms that have been used for thousands of years in a variety of different ethnic cultures. So I've heard lots of people talk about, oh, they saw a mushroom in the forest and it looked edible. And that is definitely the least recommended way to approach wild crafting of food. Death caps are in the Amanita genus and they're a deadly mushroom. They occur here in Oregon. They occur with broadleaf trees. Reportedly, they taste very good. So the same mushroom that tastes very good can kill you. As little as one mushroom, it can kill you. Some people end up on dialysis for the rest of their lives. When these mushrooms get a little bit older, they have the taste of rotting flesh. So unfortunately, not all poisonous and or deadly mushrooms are inedible. If it was that easy, there wouldn't be so much emphasis on teaching mycology. I can name a few poisonous species that are inedible. You would take a bite and you would instantly spit it out. You couldn't even chew it and swallow it. That said, there are a few deadly species of mushrooms. And of the 22,000 or so mushrooms that have been described, actually, I think there's about 100,000 mushroom species that have been described. I think there's a few thousand here in this country. And in future years, we're going to have accurate lists and archives of what we have. But researchers think that there could be 1 to 10 times the amount of undescribed fungus in the world. So the little that we do know has served us well, and it'll provide a baseline and a place for us to learn about more about how our world actually works, about how the forests come to be, about how organic matter is recycled back into the soil. So to encapsulate, there's no easy way to tell if a mushroom is edible or poisonous. You have to know each species. And just because a mushroom looks edible does not mean that it is.
Thank you. Is there dangerous mushrooms to touch? I mean, you're talking about some that are poisonous to eat. Are there any that cause a reaction as soon as you make contact with them?
That's a very good question, too. I hear that a lot when we go on forays and we talk about mushroom identification. There are no mushrooms in the United States that will harm you if you touch them. I did hear of a report of a fungus that was growing in Australia or another part of the world it's not that common, but if you touch it, it will irritate your skin. The death cap is the deadliest mushroom in the world, and you can touch that mushroom and not die. The only way to be harmed from poisonous mushrooms here in North America, as far as we know, is to take a deadly mushroom, put it in your mouth. You can cook it or eat it raw, chew it and swallow it. And that would be the only way that a deadly mushroom can harm you. There are some toxins in Lactarius species and Russula species that are heat soluble, but the toxins in Amanitas, those are amatoxins, they are not affected by heat. So you can't cook the poison out of a deadly Amanita species and render it edible. There are people who have developed a sensitivity towards mushroom spores. So sometimes people who work in mushroom cultivation operations, if they don't wear a breather mask and they're working with Ganoderma species or oyster species, Pleurota species, these mushrooms produce a lot of spores. And if we breathe them in, we can actually develop a sensitivity towards breathing in the spores. I heard a story years ago of a Boy Scout troop that was doing some raking in a park. I think it was on the East Coast. And as they were raking leaves in the fall, but they were raking up the spores from all these puffballs growing in the area. I read in that report that some of the kids got sick. So if you do see mushrooms sporulating, don't get right up on them and breathe their spores in. Mushrooms should not be eaten raw. Mushrooms like the morel and the bluet are especially toxic raw. It's just a really good policy to cook all the mushrooms that you plan on eating. And if you find yourself in the field and you're collecting king boletes or matsutakes, and if you have a little bit of bread, cheese, and wine, or maybe some smoked meats, it's not unfeasible to take small, thin slices of matsutake and or king boletus and eat them as a snack. But if you were to eat even a baby king bolete mushroom in the field raw, you would probably experience some gastrointestinal distress.
Thank you. How should someone harvest a mushroom? Is it better to cut them or pluck them?
I've heard this question come up a lot as well. So these are absolutely excellent questions. These are most of the questions that people who want to engage with fungi and mushrooms, these are some of the first questions that they ask. There was a study done by the Oregon Mycological Society years ago on whether chanterelles that were cut or pulled affected the fruiting. And the results proved that it didn't, that neither way adversely affected the fruiting. What does affect the fruiting of mushrooms in general is soil compaction and loss of habitat. That said, there are mushroom species that thrive on soil compaction. The fried chicken mushroom is one of them. There's another one called the Agaricus bitorcus. These are very edible agaricus mushrooms that love hard packed clay soil. And there are some mushrooms that respond to loss of habitat, like morels and psilocybes. When there are chanterelles that are growing in pairs, or if there's a little one, what I'll do is I won't harvest all of them. I will cut the biggest one off of a little cluster, and I'll allow the other little ones, or especially the baby ones that haven't distributed their spores, I'll allow those to continue to grow. Sapropic mushroom species, when we pull those out of the ground, it actually stimulates the mycelium to fill in that void and to potentially have more fruiting bodies. I don't know if it works that way with ectomycorrhizal species like boletus and chanterelles. I think when those mushrooms are pulled out, I think it creates a void in the mycelium. And I think over winter it gets, or over the cold season, it can repair itself. It's advised to cover our holes when we do cut or pull mushrooms out, just to be able to protect the mycelium a little bit and to not have it suffer too much from cold and or insect predation. So I think the results are inconclusive. I hear lots of people talk about they only pull their mushrooms out. I hear some people talk about they only cut them. I think until we have more information, we'll just go with soil compaction and loss of habitat as the biggest limiting factors for mushroom production. And if people are going to cut them or pull them, if they can put a little bit of the duff in the hole, that would be a best management practice for conserving fungal biodiversity.
We kind of talked already about where you find mushrooms. Yes. So what makes for a good mushroom foraging spot?
That's a really good question. And the answer to this question will make it possible for others to identify places to go hunting, foraging for mushrooms. So I think that I think that the conifer trees have more fungal biodiversity than deciduous trees. Their detritus is a little bit more acidic, and it can support a wider variety of decomposing organisms such as mites and worms, detrivores, fungus, and other agents of decay. When I'm looking at conifer forests and I'm trying to identify places to go hunt mushrooms, I look for places that have a wide variety of trees as much as possible. There are Doug-fir forests that have a lot of hemlock in them. Sometimes they'll have spruce if they're by the coast, or Sitka. They'll have different conifer community members. The natural places where there's not a lot of undergrowth and there's a closed canopy are going to harbor more types of fungus than if it's an open canopy. Some mushrooms require a little bit of light to fruit, but if there's too much light, it could end up being a limiting factor for mushroom production. It can dry out the soil and it can actually raise the humidity in the local area. So I'll look for conifer forests of various ages. Young to middle-aged forests in Oregon have the most mycological diversity. Old growth forests don't have as much because the ecological niches have been filled long ago. After a flood, a volcano, a bulldozer, or a fire, there's a lot of open ecological niches in the forest as the different plants come back to colonize. So in the young part of the tree's life, there's a lot of open ecological niches, and the first funguses there are Ascomycetes. Those are cup funguses. They will make it possible for other life forms to follow in succession. Some of the best mycodiversity we have in Oregon is in the middle-aged forests. I've been told that a lot of ectomycorrhizal species will fruit on trees that are 50 years and above. So we look for mixed forest types. If there are deciduous trees, there would need to be more conifer trees and deciduous trees to have a really good selection of mycodiversity. Little undergrowth, so you can see the ground, and a closed canopy. If there's a little bit of light that hits the ground, that's okay. But if there's too much light, it can end up as a limiting factor by drying out the soil and lowering the humidity.
So what are some common mushrooms that people forage here in the Pacific Northwest?
Some of the common mushrooms that people forage for in the Pacific Northwest, and this is good for along the coast of Oregon, on the west side of the Cascades, to a lesser extent, the east side of the Cascades, and all the way out towards the Blue Mountains and the Willowas. The golden chanterelle is just Cantharellus formosus, is the state mushroom. And that's found primarily under Doug firs. That's a very common mushroom. Most of the people I talk to who have done any kind of mushroom hunting in Oregon, if that wasn't their first mushroom that they found, it was one of the top three. There's chicken of the woods, which is Latiparus conifericola. There's another species of chicken of the woods that grows on plum trees here in Portland, Oregon, called Latiparus gilbertsoni. And it's very similar tasting. It looks a little bit different. There are king boletes that fruit under conifer trees. I find them on the coast. I've found them in the mountains, usually 2,000, 3,000 feet in elevation. We found a bunch of them yesterday. They grow, in all, most of the mountainous parts of Oregon. And when they can fruit in mind-boggling numbers. Sometimes you can't even harvest all the ones you see. And these are all mushrooms that don't have deadly lookalikes. So there's the cauliflower mushroom, which is Spirasis crispa. It looks like a bunch of egg noodles were bunched up together and stuck under the root of a tree. Those are delicious mushrooms. If you do find the cauliflower mushroom, harvest it by cutting it off at the base and leaving the base intact. That way there will be more mushrooms fruiting in future years. Shaggy manes are another popular Oregon mushroom. They are cylindrical. They turn pink first and then they turn black, and they will deliquesce into a black inky mess if you let them sit there. And they like to grow, they're saprobic in nature, so they'll grow in disturbed habitats. I see them growing on the side of roads. I see them in lawns. If you do harvest inky caps, try not to harvest them or any other mushroom that's near a possible source of pollution, like near a road or in an area that has industrial effluent running off. There's the fried chicken mushroom, Liophyllum decasts. This is the only mushroom that fruits on the ground in large clusters that has white gills and no rings. So I've seen the fried chicken mushroom fruiting on gravel roads, on the side of roads up in the forest that don't have a lot of traffic. Sometimes there will be 20, 40, or 50 mushrooms packed into this one cluster. So that's a valuable macroscopic identification characteristic for the species, is if you see clustered mushrooms growing on the ground, and if you shouldn't pick them. They won't be the fried chicken mushroom unless there's five or more fruit bodies. There are a few different species of mushrooms that aren't collected for food that fruit on the ground in smaller clusters, but only the fried chicken mushroom has many, many mushrooms in its cluster. There's the pig's ear, which is Gomphus clavatus, that has a lilac purple underside, and it's got a tan cap. And those are usually associated with conifer forests. In the spring, we can find oyster mushrooms. We can find morels. We can often find those both in the same habitats, in riparian habitats. There are morels that grow in conifer areas, and those usually occur after the snow melts. Sometimes the spring king bolete will be in the same montane habitat as the morels. So people who know where to go hunting for delicious spring mushrooms, sometimes they can come back with spring kings, with morels, and with oyster mushrooms, which would make for a delicious spring bounty. There's truffles. Truffles fruit underground. There's 1,500 different species of Hypogeus fungus that occur here in Oregon. There's about five or six species that have culinary value. There's the Oregon white truffle, there's the Oregon black truffle, there's Oregon brown truffle. Oregon white truffle can be found under Doug fir trees from late November through spring, and it'll occur anywhere from 2 to 4 inches underneath the duff. So between the duff and the mineral soil layer is where you'll see truffles. Sometimes you'll see squirrel holes. Sometimes you'll see lumps in the duff that are actually truffles fruiting underneath the ground, but it's not an edible mushroom. I think that's a good place to start. There's about 100 different mushrooms that are collected for the table in Oregon. And in my estimation, there's about 60 species that really have culinary value. The rest of the mushrooms, they cook up slimy or they don't have good textures.
So since we're talking about ways to preserve them, do you want to kind of provide some information on mushroom preservation?
Absolutely. This is another thing that people are very interested in learning about when they go out to forage mushrooms. The mushrooms that I've talked about have different methods of preparation. So if you cook a Swillis mushroom, and Swillis mushrooms is a subgenus of Boletus. These are ectomycorrhizal species of mushrooms that have relations with conifer trees. They have yellow pores and they have brown tops, but they're more slimy than Boletus. They have they're closer to the ground and they fruit in larger numbers than Boletus does. I've been picking these mushrooms for well over 20 years, and even the driest specimens I've collected still cook up slimy. So the best way to prepare Swillis for the table is to pick only the firm fruit bodies. I like to cut the stems off, and then I'll slice the caps into, an eighth or third of an inch slices, and I'll dehydrate those. They can be dehydrated and put into a jar with just the slices, or you can crush them up and powder them, and they'll last even longer. When I find chanterelles early in the season, they don't have a lot of moisture, and those are the rainbow chanterelles. So if I'm cutting them, they'll actually squeak when I cut them with a knife, and that's an indication that they can be dehydrated and then rehydrated and not come up leathery. Many people have dehydrated waterlogged chanterelles and they come up leathery and tough to chew, and they don't reconstitute that well. The good news is if you do have some of these tough, leathery chanterelles sitting in your cupboard, you can grind them up into a powder and they become quite palatable after that. King Boletus, if they're really firm, they can be cooked fresh and they could be sauteed. I've baked the buttons before. I've roasted them with elk or with squash and onions and potatoes. When boletes are, when they're sliced and dehydrated, they'll actually concentrate their flavor. So they're a little bit more palatable when they're rehydrated. Lobster mushrooms. I like to pick lobster mushrooms when they're really fresh and firm, and then I'll clean them off in the field. I'll make sure all the dirt gets off. I'll pat them dry with a towel, and I'll put them in the refrigerator to ripen in a bag, and they will ripen over 5 to 7 days. If you pinch the lobster flesh and if it starts to break, that's the best time to eat it. It'll taste, smell, and have the texture of lobster. If you cook the really firm lobster mushrooms, they're still palatable and edible, but they're a little less lobstery flavored and they're more mushroomy flavored. Truffles can be enjoyed fresh. Matsutake can be cooked. We want to cook all of our mushrooms. Matsutake can be cooked fresh as well. When they are dried out, they lose some of their subtle flavors. They still retain their chewy texture, which is desirable in many types of... Some mushrooms lend themselves to pickling and canning more than other mushrooms. Chicken of the woods is a mushroom that I've pickled and canned. I've pickled them with rice wine vinegar and ginger. I've pickled them with apple cider vinegar, cumin, and chili peppers. And I've also pickled them in balsamic vinegar with roasted garlic, olives, and Italian herbs. So they all take on these different flavors, and they can all be used in different ethnic style dishes. So canning and pickling is one method of processing mushrooms. Dehydrating or powdering them is another method. Cooking them fresh into meals is another method, and parboiling them. I'll take oyster mushrooms, I'll parboil them for 10 minutes. I'll sequester the liquid off to the side, and that makes a very nutritious drink. I can feel it going all the way in my stomach, and it helps relieve inflammation. When oyster mushrooms are parboiled and then cooled down, they can be cut into strips like seafood, and they can be used in a oyster mushroom ceviche, which is very delicious. There are some aromatic mushrooms like the candy cap and the anise-scented mushroom, which are too strong to cook into meals, but those can be dehydrated and then powdered. They can infuse liquors. They can infuse creams. They can be used in baked goods like cookies and breads and cakes. So each mushroom species has its own method of preparation, and there is lots of information in mushroom cookbooks and online for people who want to find out different ways to cook mushrooms. Hopefully I'm going to be able to have some of these resources together in some kind of presented format or a book next year. And when I have that together, I will make sure that you get a copy.
That would be great. I would be interested in reading those. So we're going to kind of switch direction.
Okay.
Are mushrooms resilient? And what is the impact that climate change is going to have on mushrooms?
Well, that is a very good question. As mushrooms are fungus is the interface between life and death here on these terrestrial habitats on Earth. Terrestrial habitats that we're familiar with are parks, forests, deserts, anywhere where there's land involved. Fungus has a resiliency to be able to occupy one or more of the four general relationships in each of these habitats that we've discussed. I think there are some funguses that live in the Arctic, but they don't grow and they don't have the kind of diversity. They don't grow to the size or have the kind of diversity that we have here at the mid-latitudes in Oregon in the forest. Since they are a species that thrives on the transition of seasons, meaning that they appear when it goes from cold to warm, or when it goes to warm to cold, they'll do most of their work underground. The mycelium is continually colonizing and feeding. And when the conditions are right, it'll send up a fruit body, which is also a mushroom, in hopes of colonizing more habitat. In the case of conifer trees, if you go into a conifer tree forest with Doug firs and cedars and hemlock and other conifer trees, there are mycorrhizal funguses that are associated with each tree species, and there's a lot of overlap between one species that is growing with one tree and another tree's roots that come in its area. In conifer-based forests, there can be a lot of redundancy with ectomycorrhizal funguses. There could be dozens of different ectomycorrhizal funguses that they have particular associations with each tree, and they don't fruit every year the same way. So some years there will be mushrooms that fruit in profusion. Cortinaria species are a good example of that. These are ectomycorrhizal species that are not collected for food, but they're indicative of forest health. Inosibi and rucellas and hebolomas, lactarias, swillices, these are all ectomycorrhizal species that can be found in great numbers in these forests, these conifer-based forests, and there's a lot of redundancy. So if the conditions aren't right for one fungus to fruit, there will be another fungus that fruits. How funguses have been adapting to climate change, I've spoken with quite a few foragers in the last few years, and this year in particular, they told me because the spring was so wet and late, everything got moved back a month. So I've been able to prove this point by going to the patches that I went to last year and either not finding mushrooms at the same time of year or finding very few. Mushroom funguses are going to adapt to what's going on in the soil. So the amount of rain, there's other contributing factors that can limit or promote the growth of mushrooms. Mushrooms in general need oxygen and nitrogen to fruit. A fungus will breathe in oxygen and it'll off-gas carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide that's off-gassed from fungal mycelium is kept at the plant layer, so it's usually cooler and wetter, and it helps provide a closed biofeedback system loop for the forests that they fruit in, because trees breathe in carbon dioxide and off-gas oxygen. Mushrooms, I think the disappearance of mushrooms is going to be, if there are mushroom species that aren't found in the usual places, it may be contributed to a variety of reasons. It could be soil compaction, loss of habitat. It could be climate change. There are going to be plants and fungal species that find new ecological niches in climate change. So, on the human scale, we live to be 70 to 100 years old. We don't see a whole lot of substantial change in these forested ecosystems in that small of a time frame. But if there has been data collected or archived, or if there's a legacy around these areas that we're looking, we can actually look at what species of mushrooms have been fruiting for the last 5 or 6 decades. And there's a few mushroom clubs in Oregon that keep really good records of which mushrooms fruit every year in the places that they go to. The Oregon Mycological Society has been around since 1949. I think they have some of these fruiting lists in the places that they go that date back to the 80s. Cascade Mycological Society is another mushroom club that has a lot of really accurate record keeping and can make it possible to ascertain which mushrooms have been fruiting over the last few decades. Also, the Lincoln County Mycological Society is another one where they, when they have a show, they have these printed out sheets that people can just check the mushrooms. The identifiers can check the mushrooms that are on the tables, and then all of that is entered into a database that club members can access. So this is quantifiable data that can assist in papers. It can provide valuable resources for people who want to learn what kind of local fungi is in their area. And if there are new things that are appearing and old ones that are fading away.
So, speaking of these different groups and organizations, how can people get more involved in the mushroom community locally?
That's another good question. I don't know how many mushroom clubs there are in Southern Oregon. I think there's a mushroom festival in Brookings, Oregon, in early October. That's a very good resource for people in the local area to find out about the different mycological resources. Don't pick mushrooms that you don't know what they are and go online to try to identify them positively, because there's too many things that can interfere with that process, and it's very difficult to get a baseline understanding of how to identify mushrooms without using the macroscopic identification characteristics, without taking notes, without not being in a hurry when you're collecting mushrooms. If you're collecting mushrooms, it's getting dark or it's raining and you're hungry, not all of you is there. You're like on your way out of the forest, you're collecting mushrooms. If you're brand new at it, you could miss easily visible clues that would be able to help you identify your species for safe identification. I think it's going to take a lot of different people working for a few similar commonalities to spread mushroom groups. I'm working with a few people in Estacada. We would like to get a mushroom club and a mushroom presence there. There's people in Yahats who want to have an expanded mushroom presence. Communities all over Oregon are getting inspired and revigorated into having a renewed or an expanded mycological presence in their communities, simply because there's more people growing mushrooms, there's more people that have questions about them. The information that's coming out about mushrooms and health is substantial, and it is possible to have relationships of reciprocity based in nature just by foraging mushrooms and acting as habitat conservationists. So we're watching many different parts of our culture. We're watching things change, and in the mushroom end of things, we're watching the old guard not necessarily get replaced by the new guard, but learn some new tricks and try to keep those resources flowing to all who are interested.
Thank you. If there is one piece of advice you could impart on the audience, what would that be?
The first thing I usually say, and I have this at the end of my answering my voicemail message, is don't eat any mushroom or plant that you cannot safely identify as an edible species. And also, what I would like to add is there are many people in every community here in Oregon that has anything to do with nature, trees, conservation, there are going to be people in every community that know something about mushrooms. And unfortunately, many of them are just not going to be standing on the street corner in your local town and saying, holding up a sign saying, come have me identify your mushrooms. So if people in rural communities where there's no mycological presence can cultivate relationships based in reciprocity with people who are already hunting mushrooms and knowing about them, where to go to look. We don't want to take your mushroom spots away from you. What we do want to learn is how to identify our own new mushroom spots and to be able to preserve some of the natural habitat where they fruit for us and future generations. So having an open mind and a curiosity and the desire to meet people in our towns, in our cities where there is no mycological presence is one of the best ways to hopefully ensure that there's something there in the future. Every kid I talk to about mushrooms can't get enough information about them. And they are honestly, if we raise our children to have a authentic connection with nature, we're going to have a much better chance of raising children that are healthy than if they're completely drawn into their electronic devices, which is rewiring their brains. So let's please keep talking to each other, have curiosity, and don't go trespassing on other people's property to hunt mushrooms, even though that's very tempting.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be a guest on Living Downstream and for all the valuable mushroom knowledge.